Well, welcome everybody. So the say the topic today that we're going to be discussing is on the theme of dying and death, but it's taken because in the Upasika days, what we do is group the different themes under that we're going to explore under different kind of aspects. Some of it is around, say, devotion. Some of it's around social aspects. Some of it's daily life practice. Some of it's meditation formulas. You know, some of it's sutta study. This is under the heading of the kind of social global context. When we were doing the brainstorming for this year's topics, which we pool from a whole bunch of advice or suggestions from various people, all of you people, usually, and amongst the group, and then particularly in our community, then this past winter, there's been quite a few deaths, and then looking at it as well in terms of not just how we cope with death or deal with it, and so, but how does one work with the situation of family, the society and culture around, especially if we're Buddhists and we live within a non-Buddhist culture, how do we approach that, how do we work with it, so I thought we'll split the day up. Because sometimes we do it in different ways. Because sometimes we'll end up splitting up into individual groups or small groups, or having different kinds of presentations. But the way we're going to work it today is I'll give a bit of a presentation around the historical, in the sense of. From a scriptural basis how is death held, how is it worked with family and or amongst the sangha, and then we'll have a group discussion. I'm sure it will go in various directions, and then we'll have a break. And then we'll come back, and I'll be turning it over to Jeannie, and Debbie is going to be pulled in as well to give perspectives on being with family at the time of death or period of dying, and also part of it is. What do we do after death as well? So those are our aspects to explore. And when we come together after the break, there was a very good suggestion to begin that by listening to a short eulogy that Ajahn Yatiko gave at the funeral of his brother who committed suicide last September. So then that was in Edmonton, Canada, and 300 people in the church, very non-Buddhist setting, and then it's a good example of what to do, or how he did it. So I think it'd be a an interesting way to then seed the discussion of and having Jeannie and Debbie sort of to fleshing it out and then having another discussion, and then we close with a short meditation. Yeah, I think one of the things to begin with is that, because sometimes it doesn't, you know, every time you're sick doesn't mean you're going to die. So, but there's still a you know, sense of the advice that the Buddha gave to a sick person endowed with five qualities is easy to tend to. So he does what is amenable to his cure. He knows the proper amount of things amenable to his cure. He takes his medicine. He tells his symptoms as they actually are present to the nurse desiring his welfare, saying that they are worse when they are worse, improving when they are improving, or remaining the same when they are remaining the same. And he is the type who can endure bodily feelings that are painful, fear, sharp, racking, repellent, disagreeable, life-threatening. A sick person endowed with these five qualities is easy to tend to. So that's a nice... And then in the same instructions that the Buddha gives, speaking about a nurse, somebody who's nursing the sick. A nurse endowed with five qualities is fit to tend to the sick. He is competent at mixing medicine, knows what is amenable or unamenable to the patient's cure, taking away things that are unamenable and bringing things that are amenable. Is motivated by thoughts of goodwill, not by material gain. Does not get disgusted at cleaning up excrement, urine, saliva, or vomit. And is competent at instructing, urging, rousing, encouraging the sick person at the proper occasions with tapa dhamma. The nurse endowed with these five qualities is fit to tend to the sick. Those are lovely reflections on that area.
Ajahn, where does that passage come from?
Comes from the Mahavata, which is the Vinaya text. It's a text on the discipline of the training, the rules of training for a monk. So we've got lots of rules, and there's lots of occasions where the Buddha gives advice on different things. And so here's one where he would have laid down a rule about something, and then he would talk about the circumstance in ways that would encourage people. There's a very lovely discourse by... this is in Anguttara 6, Sutta number 16. This is a discourse that was... the occasion was... there's a husband and wife who, at the time of the Buddha, when they first met the Buddha, they addressed him as their son. And the Buddha didn't correct them. And then the months after sort of said, what was that all about? And then the Buddha said, in previous lives I've been their son for many, many lifetimes. It wasn't this lifetime, but previous lifetime. So they were drew very close to the Buddha and had an affinity. And they were both the husband and wife were very solid practitioners. Anyway, now on that occasion, the householder Nakula Pita, that's the Nakula the father, and Nakula Mata is Nakula the mother. Nakula Pita was sick, afflicted, gravely ill. Then the housewife Nakula Mata said this to him: "Do not die full of concern, householder. To die full of concern is painful. To die full of concern has been criticized by the Blessed One." And then she goes on to say, there's different things that she brings up that you don't have to be concerned about, you don't have to worry about. Says, it may be, householder, that you think this, thus, after I'm gone, Nikula Maka won't be able to support her children or maintain the household. But you should not look at the matter in this way. I am skilled at weaving cotton, knitting wool. After you are gone, I'll be able to support the children and maintain the household. Therefore, householder, do not die full of concern. To die full of concern is painful. To die full of concern has been criticized by the Blessed One. And then he said, it may be, householder, that you think thus. After I'm gone, Nikula Maka will take another husband. But you should look at it as, yeah, you know, householder, and so do I, that for the last 16 years we have led the lay person celibate life. Therefore, householder, do not die full of concern. Maybe that after I'm gone, Nikula Maka won't want to see the Blessed One in the Sangha of Bhikkhus. But you should not look at the matter in this way. He said, after you are gone, householder, I'll be even keener to see the Blessed One in the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Therefore, householder, do not die full of concern. And he goes on to say, Nikula Maka does not fulfill virtuous behavior. And said, and should not look at the matter in this way. I'm one of the Blessed One's white-robed female lay disciples who fulfills virtuous behavior. If anyone has any doubt or uncertainty about this, the Blessed One, the Arahant, perfectly enlightened one, say, is dwelling in the deer park at Vesakala Grove, they can go and ask him. So don't bother getting concerned about that. Maybe that Nikula Maka does not obtain internal serenity of mind. And of course, said, don't worry about that. I've got, I'm one of the lay disciples who can obtain serenity of mind. Nikula, and it may be, householder, that you think thus. Nikula Maka has not attained a foothold, a firm stand, assurance in this Dhamma and discipline. She has not crossed over doubt, gotten rid of bewilderment, attained self-confidence, and become independent of others in the teacher's teaching. But you should not look at the matter in this way. And she sort of affirms her solidity in the Dhamma. And if anyone has any doubt about that, go and ask the Buddha. So then, while the householder Nikula Pitta was being exhorted in this way by his housewife, Nikula Maka, his ailment subsided on the spot. Nikula Pitta recovered from that illness, and that is how his illness was abandoned. Then, not long after he had recovered, the householder Nikula Pitta, leaning on a staff, approached the Blessed One. He paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down to one side. The Blessed One then said to him, it is truly your good fortune and gain, householder, that the housewife Nikula Maka has compassion for you, desires your good, and exhorts and instructs you. Nikula Maka is one of my white-robed female lay disciples who fulfills, and he goes through everything that she laid out that might be a concern. She says, pup, 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 pup. She has crossed over doubt, gotten rid of bewilderment, attained self-confidence, become independent of others in the teacher's teaching. She's a stream enterer. It is truly a good fortune and gain, householder, that the housewife Nikula Maka has compassion for you, desires your good, and exhorts and instructs you. So that's a very beautiful sutta of the time of the Buddha, say husband and wife who look after each other and then instructed on what was concerned at the time, maybe he's going to die, and of course he got better, but it wasn't the discourse was certainly effective. So those are, I think, an interesting perspective in the sense of the lay people supporting each other, encouraging each other, and looking after each other in terms of Dhamma.
It seems interesting that his that when he was sick, his concern was about that his wife or the people left behind. And, I think that's actually very common among people who are dying, like I know.
Yeah.
when my wife's dad was very ill, you know, he's like, well, you're going to take care of my baby when I'm gone, and, you know, things like this. And I think that's something that's very common that we would encounter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and those are, I think those are you know, in terms of how we, these fundamental concerns that are important to understand so that one can address them. Because it's, you know, some things are just quite they're very much a part of human nature. And it's important to be cognizant of that so that one can address it or be present for those concerns and be able to help alleviate that. Taylor.
Sorry.
Yeah?
Never mind.
Okay. There's another this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, Samyutta 41, Sutta number 10. It's a discourse on Jitta, the householder, who was, now on that occasion, Jitta, the householder, was sick, afflicted, gravely ill. And I'll summarize as we go along, so I'm not reading out absolutely everything. But anyway, what happened is a whole bunch of the devatas that live nearby, as celestial beings in the area, came and sort of said, make a wish, householder, thus. May I become a wheel-turning monarch in the future. And what is a... how do you say, the devas recognized that this person had exceptional virtue and a storehouse of goodness, and if he made an aspiration, he could become, you know, somebody really important and rich in a future life, or in the next life. And when this was said, Jitta the householder said to those devas, that too is impermanent, that too is unstable. One must abandon that too and pass on. So he's basically just sort of disregarding the devas and sort of saying, no, that's, I don't want to go there. When this was said, of course, he's surrounded with his friends and relatives. He said, when this was said, Jitta the householder's friends and companions, relatives and kinsmen said to him, set up mindfulness, master, don't babble. Because they can't see the devas. So they think he's starting to lose it. Getting to the end of his life, he's getting close to death, and he's losing the plot. So he says, what did I say that makes you speak to me thus? You said to us, that too is impermanent, that too is unstable. One must abandon that too and pass on. And he says, well, that's because these devas came. I just told them, no, I don't want to do that. And he said, and what advantage do those devas see, master, that they speak to you like this? And he says, well, those devas think Jitta the householder is virtuous, of good character. If he should wish, you know, that would, his wish would succeed because of its purity. And you know, it's a great benefit to many people to have somebody with that kind of virtue in positions of power. Then they said, I said to them, that too is impermanent, that too is unstable, one must abandon that too and pass on. Then his friends and relatives say, well, then exhort us too, householder. Then, therefore, you should train yourselves thus, we will be possessed of confirmed confidence in the Buddha, and having confidence and faith, satthā, and Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And then also say, whatever there may be in our family that can be given away, all that we will share, all that we will share unreservedly with virtuous ones who are of good character. It is in such a way that you should train yourselves. Then, having inspired confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, among his friends and colleagues, his relatives and kinsmen, and having exhorted them in generosity, Jitta the householder passed away. That's the story of Jitta the householder. And he was, what is he foremost in? Can't remember.
Expounding the Dhamma?
Expounding, that's true. Like, yeah. He was the layman who was foremost in expounding the Dhamma. So that there's, say, these monks, nun, layman, laywoman, who would be foremost in expounding the Dhamma. So he was the layman who was most skilled in expounding Dhamma.
So if people that we're with when they're dying seem to be mumbling, maybe talking to Dhamma.
Could be.
They may be having some experience that we're not tuned in.
No, absolutely. Because those are also times when, on a certain level, consciousness opens a bit. You know, where we're not so confined by our habits of perception and our assumptions of selfhood. Which is also why, in many times, it's a very important time for one being present for people, as well as for giving some guidance or giving some perspectives that help them to clarify, because there's a great example of that it's a raging controversy still in Sri Lanka, Sarikani. He's somebody. Sarikani is a Sakyan, and the Buddha declared him to be a stream enterer, no longer bound to the lower worlds, fixed in destiny with enlightenment as his destination, which is a characteristic of the stream enterer. And then thereupon, a number of Sakyans, having met and assembled, deplored this, grumbled and complained about it, saying, "It is wonderful indeed, sir. It is amazing indeed, sir." These are idioms that are used in the suttas. "Now, who here won't be a stream enterer when the Blessed One has declared Sarikani, the Sakyan, after he died, to be a stream enterer? Sarikani, the Sakyan, was too weak for the training. He drank intoxicating drink." So they're saying, "God, if that drunk Sarikani can do it, who wouldn't?" It's actually the Buddha's cousin who comes to ask him about this, who Mahanama, who is the current ruler of the Sakyans, and he's saying, "Well, there's." It's like rolling the apple into the wedding party, and with this one, and everybody's grumbling about it, and the Buddha kind of reiterates that that it's with this sense of confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and having a sense of appreciation for the truths that that the Buddha teaches, and that are the cause for that to take place, and he said Sarakani the Sakyan undertook the training at the time of his death, in the sense that it really hit him the truth of those teachings at the time of his death, and that's a which is, you don't want to wait all that long. Sometimes it happens, and it's important to recognize again that the power of that time of death, where you really sort of hits you. Yeah, what was the point of that? And then the truths of the teachings really hit home, and there's an opening there to set aside the different concerns and worries and obsessions that the mind easily gets caught up in. So that sense of the time of death is an important window of opportunity, both for the person who's dying, but also for the person who is people who are supporting and around them, and which is, say, like in a traditional setting. My experience is in Thailand, and if somebody is dying, then one would say have people close by who are sitting quietly, trying to create a quiet space, rather than having a whole lot of hubbub going on, a whole lot of confusion and chaos. So really surrounding the person with a sense of calm. And that's an important aspect. And that's oftentimes where there'll be invite monastics to come and chant at that time, because those are it's very soothing to have that chanting. I can remember so many times we've gone to the hospitals with here, even here in America, where we have chanted in hospital rooms of people who are dying, and then the nurses down the hall and the other people around said, "Wow, that was great. Come back again." So just the presence of that calm quality of the chanting, having teachers visit to give instruction encouragement around the period of death, helping to that sense of establishing mindfulness and recollection around the teachings and the practice, and that is a supportive factor for the person to be able to establish a clarity of heart and a peacefulness of mind, which is. And that's the kind of mind that you want to help establish for a person who is dying in that death process. The more peaceful and clear that person can be, the more beneficial it is for themselves in that time, but then also, and in particular in terms of a Buddhist context, that's a factor in a favorable rebirth. And well, that's a, you know, just is efficacious. When, yeah, and this is a good excellent example of that with Anathapindika, who is the layman who was, he invited the Buddha to go to Savatthi, to establish a monastery there, establish the Jetas Grove, where the Buddha lived for, he lived there longer than any other place that he resided in his life, in his life as a monastic, as a monk. And so he was a monk for 45 years. I think he was about 19 years at the Jetas Grove. And when and Anathapindika served the Sangha, looked after the Sangha, supported the Sangha all through that time, and he, of course, as he got older and he became ill, and toward the end of his life, then he invited the Venerable Sariputta to come. He said, he requested Sariputta to visit him. He had a particular affinity to Sariputta. And then Sariputta went to the residence of the householder of Anathapindika with the Venerable Ananda as his attendant. Having gone there, he sat down to see, blah, 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 and asked Anathapindika, "I hope you are getting well, householder. I hope you are comfortable. I hope your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and that their subsiding, not their increase, is apparent." And then Anathapindika responds, "Venerable Sariputta, I am not getting well, I am not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase and not their subsiding is apparent. Just as if a strong man were splitting my head open with a sharp sword, so too violent winds cut through my head. I am not getting well." And just as if, and goes, describes his discomfort, getting tough leather strap wrapped around my head as a headband, so too there are painful feelings in my head. And just as if a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife, so too violent winds are carving up my belly. I am not getting well. And just as if two strong men were to seize a weaker man by both arms, roast him over a pit of hot coals, so too there is a violent burning in my body. I am not getting well. I am not comfortable. And then he said, and Sariputta, "Then, householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to the eye, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the eye. You should train yourself thus. I will not cling to the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the mind. You should train yourself thus. I will not cling towards the internal sense bases, the external sense bases, in the sense that I will not cling to sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mind objects, and my consciousness will not be dependent on that. Not be dependent on the eye consciousness, not dependent on the contact that I'm making through the six senses." So he's parsing out the six senses and everything that one experiences through the senses. He says, "I'll not cling to the earth element, the water element, the fire element, the air element, the space element, and the consciousness element." So those fundamental elements, are not cling to those elements, and any consciousness that arises dependent will not be dependent on those things. And it's not be going externally. And then same with not cling to material form, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, the five khandhas. So the Buddha's going, Buddha's going through these different bases of our experience. And I will not cling to this world, my consciousness will not be dependent on this world. I will not cling to the world beyond, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the world beyond. Thus you should train yourself. I will not cling to what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought after, and examined by the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on that. When this was said, the householder Natapindika wept and shed tears. Then the Venerable Ananda asked him, "Are you foundering, householder? Are you sinking?" "I am not foundering, Venerable Ananda. I am not sinking. Although I have long waited upon the teacher and bhikkhus worthy of esteem, never before have I heard such a talk on the Dhamma." So I'd say, just delighting in the Dhamma that was taught, and saying that those are, he said, generally there's not, don't teach that, the lay people. But the say, well, that it'd be great if the that there will be, there are clansmen, and said, well, Venerable Sariputta, let such talk on the Dhamma be given to lay people clothed in white. There are clansmen with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away through not hearing such talk on the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. Then after giving the householder Natapindika this advice, the Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Ananda rose from their seats and departed. Soon after they had left, the householder Natapindika died and reappeared in the Tusita heaven, which is quite a higher heavenly realm. And he was a stream enter. So he... And then when the night was well advanced, Natapindika, now a young god of beautiful appearance, went to the Blessed One, the Buddha, illuminating the whole of Jeta's Grove. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he stood at one side and addressed the Blessed One in standards, and he praises the Jeta's Grove and the Sangha and the Buddha, the aspects of virtue and nobility that have been cultivated there, because he gave the place, so he's just delighting in it, and that such goodness has been a part of that, and then praising Sariputta in particular. Sariputta has reached the peak in virtue, peace, and wisdom's ways. Any bhikkhu who has gone beyond at best can only equal him. And so then that was the next day, then the Buddha tells the bhikkhus and the Sangha about this, what happened in this Deva showing up and the verses that he that the Deva said, and then the Buddha said that is what that young god has said. Then the young god, thinking the teacher has approved of me, paid homage to me, keeping me on his right, he vanished at once. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Surely, Venerable Sir, that young god must have been Natapindika, for the householder of Natapindika had perfect confidence in the Venerable Sariputta." "Good, good, Ananda. As far as reasoning goes, you have drawn the right conclusion. That young god was Natapindika, no one else." That is what the Blessed One said. Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One. That's a beautiful discourse. And that sense of, yeah, again, that that bringing those teachings at the time of death are important qualities. So that creating wholesome conditions around a person who is ill, who is dying, are the, let's say, us, whether it's us as monastics or as lay people, as friends, as relatives of people who are dying, then that trying to create some kind of peaceful, reflective atmosphere, and trying to see that when one can, in different ways, seeding that with reflections, and you know sometimes that's possible, sometimes it's not. But that again, that'll I think say like Jeannie and Debbie will be sort of fleshing that out a bit more of this, later. Any questions? Yeah.
Just a more of a logistical. We've always talked about the Jada's Grove and the Pendicus Park. What is actually a Jada's Grove? Is that a type of tree? Is that a, what's it?
Jada was a prince.
A prince. Okay.
So it was a former owner, Prince Jada, was the owner of it, and at the Pindaka he didn't want to sell it, and then he said something like, I'd only sell it if you were able to, you know, lay the whole thing with gold coins, which was sort of like, you know, just like the, you know, it was an idiom that he was using to say, you know, say, no way, I'm never going to sell this. But because he said that, then Anatta Pindika said, right, it's a deal. And then he went back and got ox carts of his, from his, he was the wealthiest person in Savatthi. Mm-hmm. And he came and started laying it out. And of course, then he was going, then Prince Jeta is sort of, no way, I wasn't selling this. And then they had to take it to arbitration. And then, to the city elders and rulers, and they said, what you said, this is what you said, and this is what he's doing, you have to agree. You created the deal. So then Anatta Pindika came and started covering the whole Jada's Grove with gold coins. And he got to a point where there was just one corner left. And he ran out of coins. He said, well, and he said, sent his counselors or whatever to go back to his storehouse to get more coins, and Prince Jenga said, it's okay, I'll give the hat. So they ended up naming it Jada's Grove. Yeah.
Jada Grove is the name of the monastery that Ajahn Jayanto is creating in New Hampshire.
That's right, I forgot about that. Yeah, mm-hmm. So there will be a Jada Grove.
Where is the original Jada's Grove? Where is it?
Which one?
The first one we've been talking about.
Savatthi, which is north of, you know better than me.
Isn't it the modern day Sarnath?
No, it's not that's Sarnath. Where the Buddha gave his first sermon, okay. Sarnath. Savatthi is sort of north from there, in Uttar Pradesh.
Is it? It's not north of Rajagaha, is it?
No, it's more, more west. More west and north of like Benares.
There's in the books by Ajahn Suchito, there's the map.
Okay.
The library.
Is that where he went?
He did the whole route.
He did the whole circus. Mm-hmm. Went everywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had a question about the previous sutta.
Yeah.
About the drunken man who achieved stream entry at the end of his life. And before you started to talk about it, I thought you said something about it was controversial in Sri Lanka, and I wondered if you could say a little bit more about it.
Well, I mean, it's sort of the same controversy that the Sakyans were. You know, how is it? It is one, and this is sort of more like, this is not an exclamation, this is sort of like deprecating, sort of, it is wonderful indeed. It is amazing indeed. How can this, how can this be?
Even in present day, you're saying? Even in present day Sri Lanka?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it doesn't matter what religion, everybody loves a controversy. Something that you can, you know, generate opinions around. An aspect of, you know, how can that be? How can that be possible?
And it's sort of emblematic of the whole greater controversy, if you will, of how easy is it to attain stream entry, you know?
Right.
Because there are some people who will say and define it as something that anybody can do, really, with just a little bit of effort, and there's other people who will say it's actually impossible in this day and age.
Yes.
You know, for anybody to attain stream entry, and pretty much everything in between.
Yes. And in a bigger context, that's a really important point. In that sense of any kind of noble attainment is just so impossibly refined and abstruse, and therefore it's just not accessible to ordinary people in this day and age. Basically, you've got to make aspirations for the next Buddha, because we haven't lucked out. We weren't born during the Buddha's time. This time around, so we've got to hope for the next one. But there's, that's certainly not the within the Thai forest tradition. Then there's a very strong emphasis on the here and now teachings. These teachings are they're apparent here and now. If one practices them, sees them, realizes them, one will reap the fruits of those insights. And the way that the Buddha actually ends that sutta about Sarakhani, he's in this particular grove with these types of big tree, and he said, even if these great sal trees, Mahanama, could understand what is well spoken and what is badly spoken, then I would declare these great sal trees to be stream enterers, no longer bound. How much more than Sarakhani? In the sense that if one can really understand what's true and what's false, what's in accordance with Dhamma, what's not in accordance with Dhamma, that's your opening to realizing something that frees one from suffering. And how much more than Sarakhani the Sakya? So that sense of, and of course what it does is put the emphasis back on how do we protect the faculties within us that are able to discern what is true, what is not true, what's in accordance with truth, what's not in accordance with truth. How do we not get hooked by our own kind of attachments and defilements, be able to release them? Tim?
So along those same lines, I was thinking, I have a question. Because I've read in the sutras that the wise protect their diligence as their greatest treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, how does one protect one's diligence?
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, well, particularly when one is sick. It's a very good question in a sense. How do you do that when you're sick? Your faculties are starting to dissipate. How does one protect one's diligence? And because oftentimes when we think of diligence, and especially in terms of diligently practicing the Dhamma, then we think of doing something. I've got to do something to be a good practitioner. And if I can't sit in meditation or recite the suttas, or then I'm not fulfilling my duty. And that's not really the case, because the diligence is an internal mindfulness and reflective quality. So having that internal awareness and attention to a kind of inner contemplation. So that's one's diligence. So, and similarly also, you're sort of fleshing it out a bit in the sense of there's a diligence that is discerning what is unskillful, unwholesome, in that sense. Okay, one knows the mind so well and one's habit so well that one sees when the mind starts to go toward some kind of proliferation of desire, of fantasy, of irritation, aversion, of fear and confusion. So then one can relinquish that as it's arising. And then similarly, the diligence in terms of supporting the wholesome that leads to well-being, to clarity, to a sense of joy, spaciousness.
Okay. Question. I know maybe this will come up later, but is there a meditation practice to use with someone who is dying and has enough awareness to understand what's happening?
A lot of it is around a lot of it being attentive to what the person, what's the background. It's good to know a little bit about the person, so that they have a sense. Okay, what are they? What were they interested in? What's the basis of their faith? What's the basis of their confidence, and how to support that? Also, in the sense of, you want to keep it simple, especially if somebody is in the active process of dying, then you want to give them something that helps them to settle and feel at ease. So that there's a great story that Ram Dass tells of he's with his mother, and of course he's this is many years ago, you know, he's fired up with all these teachings and he's with his mother who's dying, and he's, you know, wanting her to do this meditation and to that meditation, and set her mind up like this, and do that, do this visualization, and after a while, I mean, she's sort of laying there. Richard Alper, his name. Richard, shut up. And then he said, because, you know, so much of it was from his own fear, his own kind of nervousness, discomfort with his, you know, and then sort of having an idea about what he thought she should be doing, and so you have to be careful with that in a sense, and that's where, you know, being with, and that's where I say in our own practice. Contemplation of death, contemplation of illness, contemplation of aging, are really important in order to feel comfortable when you're with somebody else who's going through that process. Because if we're still uncomfortable with it, don't accept our own mortality or our own limitations, then it's going to bring up fear on our part, and then people feel that. So that being comfortable within ourselves in order to be present with other people, it's important aspect. Yeah.
It took me a minute to get to the point. I was contemplating anicca.
Yeah.
And recognizing that here in the West, we just pretty much define it as impermanence.
Yeah.
And yet, we know that also in the East, a lot of it, people think of anicca in terms of uncertainty, or both.
Yeah.
And I said, so what? And I started just sitting with it, and I said, you know, it's really easier to talk about impermanence because it's out there.
Yeah.
Whereas anicca, whereas uncertainty is usually imminent. In other words, we're uncertain as to what's going to happen when I put my foot down, or who's coming through the door.
Yeah.
And so. And when we talk about uncertainty, what's not uncertainty, but impermanence, what's the thing that we really go to is our own lifespan. Mm-hmm. In other words, when we talk about being impermanent, and just like you say, now I do every morning contemplate and recite about sickness, old age, and death, and yet, when I stop to ask myself, you know, so do people really believe they're going to die? And all my experience with hospice, very few ever do really believe that. So I said, do I believe that I'm going to die? And at some level, I had to say, maybe not. Because if, in fact, I really believed it, I still wouldn't be doing anything unwholesome, unwise. If it was really had taken hold, it would be different.
Yeah, that's great. It's a great reminder. Which is exactly why those reflections are good, because they help us to really look more closely. Okay, what are our, how does it line up?
For the previous sutta brought something up for me, which is the contemplation that if we're with somebody who's dying, even if we know them really well, and also if we don't know them very well, mm-hmm. we can't really know what their consciousness has been, or what their karma is. Mm-hmm. So not to make judgments one way or the other, or mm-hmm. think that we know. And so in that, because the consciousness can be really open when somebody's dying, just the usefulness of bringing to mind the wholesome things that they've done,
yeah.
so that they're alive here, even if they're mixed with mm-hmm. Hurtful things,
yeah.
and also to maybe bring them verbally to that person,
yeah.
to encourage them. If we can't tell where they are,
yeah.
to encourage them to be in a wholesome mind state.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that reminds me of a something that I heard that is a. And I can't remember the proper name that they use. In Sri Lankan culture, one of the things they do for somebody who is born, and you get a book as a gift. And in that book, when you start to grow up, you start to write all the good things that you've done. Mm-hmm. And that's a book that you keep mm-hmm. through your life. And when it comes to your death, your friends and relatives read that to you. Mm-hmm. It's a really lovely, yeah. lovely custom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so practical and so helpful because it is easy. I mean, it's just the nature of our minds. It's easy to forget the good things. And then, have vivid memories of the bad things. At that time, it's not so helpful.
Okay, we start writing now.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember one of the most beautiful times I was called into the hospital. A woman was dying. It was around midnight, and her family was there. And so we did some prayers. And she and her husband had been married like over 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so he began his, the conversation came up. And so he talked about how they met, you know, when they were like 16 or 17, two different religions.
Mm-hmm.
And in Mexico, and he was coming there with guns to the wedding because he didn't know if he was going to get killed by someone in her family. And vice versa. And he started this beautiful story of their journey. Mm-hmm. Running away, coming to Mexico, coming to America, and we were just all around. As he told the story, she just passed away in the middle of the beautiful telling of the story of their life. And it was so touching to be able to be invited to be part of that.
Yeah, that's lovely. Yeah, those are, you know, just bringing those things to mind is so important. Yeah, me.
So, living in the West, the odds are that most of us are going to die in a hospital.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be a lot of calm, peaceful people. It's going to be shift changes in the nursing staff, and machines, and a TV with soap operas and advertisements. And can you offer any advice about how to die in the West?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, on a very practical level, is the what's it called? The
advanced directive.
Advanced directive. Mm-hmm. You definitely want to have your advanced directive signed and witnessed, so that you don't end up in a situation where you don't want to be in. So that's on a practical level. I think on a on another level, especially as one is a has cultivated spiritual friendship with fellow seekers, letting people know and actually requesting people to be present. Again, that's sort of one of the things of, say, having community is so important. It's something that within, say, like a Buddhist community, that people can be doing. And I think Debbie and Jeannie will be addressing that later, and being able to flesh that out a bit, but I think that certainly the contact with Sangha and Sangha in the broader sense of both the monastic and the lay community. I was thinking of what comes to mind is somebody who was associated with us, Jay, who lived here, lived over close to Dennis's for many years, and he had cancer in his mouth that ended up spreading all through him, and ended up in hospital, and because of it was his pneumonia in the end that kept him in hospital, so that they wouldn't let him out. So that some of the monastic communities, lay community, we went and just stayed with him, and until he died. And that was doing chanting, just being around, being present. He was in and out, and then in the end, he's a very private person, so that he didn't die until we went out of the room. So that's another thing, actually, is sometimes you have to be attentive to somebody's, you know, if you're hovering too much, then people are uncomfortable, or they're, you know, they're especially in many situations they might feel that they're, it's almost like an imposition to die in your presence.
Just to add to that question, you know, I mean, to surround yourself with people who will, you know, be able to maybe support you outside of the hospital, and then just don't go, you know, even if the forces are pushing in that direction. But then also to realize that, you know, if you do have some advocates, and maybe even if you don't, a lot of hospitals these days are starting, you know, are recognizing that the time of death should be something that's peaceful. And, you know, once the decision is made to let things go naturally, you know, there doesn't need to be, even in the hospital, there doesn't need to be, you know, lots of noise and lights and activity and machines and tubes and all that kind of stuff. And in fact, just with Jay, that situation, you know, the Ukiah Hospital really did a fantastic job, gave him a private room at the end of the hall. It was quiet, gave him lots of space, just kind of checked in every now and then and let us and him do our thing. And
just sort of, it was
quite
very clear. Mm-hmm. It was clear to them that he was dying. So
mm-hmm.
That was
great.
Good.
They were great. Yeah.
It's a little different because it was a hospice, but Tolu, my husband, the last 6 weeks of his life, we were in this room, which is, for all intents and purposes, is a hospital room. Mm-hmm. There was a little shelf. We had a Buddha Rupa with a nightlight underneath it. Most of the time, we were playing very low, very old, beautiful, sacred music.
Mm-hmm.
And people knew anyone who came into that room, the tea lady, whatever, as soon as they walked through, they had that cloth, even though there was no door, a cloth kind of sort of privacy. They immediately picked up on that atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, the last couple of weeks, staff would come in and kind of go to me, "It's so lovely in here, can I just stand over here for a minute?" So, you know, I think
yeah.
He came with intention and with other ways to create sanctuary, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to contribute. I don't know what it's like when you're actually dying. I can't remember what the paperwork part is, but at least in our country, in my experience, like, I've been really sick with pneumonia, but I'm not that fond of hospitals, and I've signed myself out against the wishes of the physician. And so that is a possibility. Like, if you think it would be more healing, if the person is still able to write, that person can sign him or herself out of the hospital
okay.
against the wishes of the physician.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's good. That's a good piece of information.
Yeah, if they, Mike's pretty recent experience, if the hospitals now, maybe just due to economics, believe your terminal, they send you home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's no, and they also don't go to great lengths to maintain people who are terminal on life support or do emergency procedures to revive them if they begin to go. And that advanced health care directive in California, you can do it online. There's a statutory one, and you can fill it out, and it's valid. And what you do is you're designating someone to make these decisions for you, and you're also telling your doctors that if you're terminal, you don't want to be prolonged unnecessarily, and that you, and that this other person that has the authority to move you home and create this atmosphere.
Okay. Why don't we move? I want to move the theme a bit. Because we've been speaking about cramping up here. What am I doing? Is with as we have to say, as death approaches, at the time of death, but then after death, what do we do? Within a Buddhist culture. I think it's pretty universal, say across Buddhist cultures, doing ceremonies that are say, dedication of merit, dedication of blessings, of that. One does things that are wholesome, that are good, that one makes a dedication to that person. So what, how the shape that takes is oftentimes what will happen is either a few days, a week, 100 days, a year, 2 years, then one would, you know, one of the most common ways is just coming to the monastery and doing a meal offering, and or offering a dish, offering a meal, offering to the Sangha, so that, and then during the chanting is a dedication of merit and blessings, and there's a little water vessel that is used, and then just sort of tipping the water from one vessel into the other, and the logic behind it is one just having something that's tangible that you're doing, so that you, because the merit is not transferred through the water, the merit is transferred through the mind that is actually on track, rather than just sort of thinking this, thinking that, and hoping for the best. So that being able to focus on bringing to mind that particular person, bringing to mind the goodness that's being done, and then bringing to mind the wish for that goodness to be a benefit to that person. So that's a that's the, let's say, the logic or the ceremony behind that, and those are that that when we do that chant of say when we do the blessing ceremony, the meal blessing chant, so just as water which is rained in the hills flows down into the valleys, just so a gift given here benefits those who have passed away. Just as the rivers fill the ocean, just so a gift given here benefits those who have passed away. And this is a recollection of that. And then that's usually the time when people are doing water pouring. And then there's another discord, or another chant that we do particularly when it's for a dedication of merit, a chant that we do translates. They gave to me, they worked for me, they were my relatives, friends, and companions. Give offering to those who have deceased, remembering what was done in the past. Neither crying nor sorrow nor any lamentation is of any use to them, our kinsmen who stand there. But the offerings given to the well-established Sangha have long-lasting benefits. It is their proper cause. Thus, the duty of kin, relatives, has been explained. Respectful devotion made for those deceased. Strength has been given. In doing so, you have made not a little merit. That's something that is very punya. And the Buddha also said punya is another word for happiness. It's a lovely recollection that those things are the chanted, the recollected on, rejoicing in the good that's done. So those are very typical within Buddha society, but then of course all sorts of different ways of doing that are also and people will make donations to hospitals, to schools, to any kind of worthy cause, really. And that recollection of that goodness and the benefit that comes, and then bringing to mind the person who one is wanting to benefit, that's the sort of the dedication of merit, is in that bringing to mind. And so that those are very typical, ordinary ways within a Buddhist culture that people deal with with death and separation, is trying to bring to mind it, both the goodness of the person, like there's a it's like there's a verses from the Dhammapada, reflecting both on our own good deeds and our own virtues. And when we appreciate fully the benefit of our own pure deeds, we are filled with joy here and hereafter. There is a celebration of joy here and hereafter. Those who live their lives well abide in happiness. They are filled with a natural appreciation of virtue, and they dwell in delight. And just that recollection, that remembering, is a both for ourselves and for others, is a powerful source of well-being. And so as we using ceremony and ritual offerings, they perform a very useful function, because oftentimes with death and then there's separation, and that grief of separation is then there's something that we can be doing that helps to bring up a sense of happiness and well-being. I guess I'll use John as the example. During the winter retreat, John wanted to make a meal offering for his father, who passed away 2 years ago, and then of course he was going to do it all by himself. And in order to have done it all by himself, all the things that he planned, he'd have had to start the days before, and gone for 24 hours a day. But then what happened, of course, is what happens when you do something good, then other people want to help. So all sorts of other people started helping out, and then turned into a really fun thing. So that isn't, I think that's something that that I've seen in, say, like in Thai culture, is how much fun they have doing things that are of you think, well, God, so the death ceremony, well, it should be miserable, but everybody has a good time, and it's a bit more wholesome than an Irish wake, which I'm more familiar with.
This is kind of an odd question, but I actually mean it in all seriousness. In terms of like the dedicating merit, is there a place for our four-legged companions that are beloved in our life when they pass to
I don't even have that much knowledge of the two-legged.
So
I don't know.
I mean, I think about it for myself, and I also think about it like in my work. It's happened quite a few times where people call and they're really distraught. They've lost their
they're animals, you know,
yeah.
and they're so grief stricken.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about this, like, you know, like being able to perhaps, you know, I mean, I guess you could just make it up. There's no harm. Like, well, you know, do a dedication for your
for your dog.
Offer something for your your cat that just died. You know, go do a
good
deed. And, you know,
it's,
like
it doesn't it doesn't actually change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's that's one of the things that there's a discourse in the Anguttara. Where Anguttara 10.177, where the Buddha is talking with the Brahman, Janasoni, he's a very high-ranking Brahman. And the Brahman is asking about the dedications of merit, and, you know, is this, does it work? And the Buddha sort of points to, you know, different circumstances where, yeah, it works. But maybe not all the time. And then he said, well, if it doesn't work, then, and then the Buddha said, well, you know, there's always going to be, even if that person doesn't receive that dedication of merit, should always be dedicating it in the way that it benefits some relative, some friend, because you always have relatives, friends, loved ones, who are ready to receive that, ready to benefit from that. And then it goes down, down, down. And then the Buddha is one thing that it, let's say, one person who always benefits from those acts of goodness is the donor. So that, you know, even if you're you know, logically somehow you end up excluding everybody, you still can't exclude <them. laughs>
Yeah.
I am somebody, I guess, a Westerner who hasn't participated in dedication of merits until just this winter. And I'll just simply say it's worth trying.
Well, especially when there's a really true gratitude, you know, like, because, you know, for myself, I mean, you know, she's a very good companion and helps me in my life in a lot of ways. But I actually have one other quick question, which was about, like, dedicating merit, like, when people, like, before they die, but they're approaching their death. Maybe, you know, they're in the, maybe not the, you know, right before they're going to pass, but maybe they're starting to, you know, they're starting to approach that. So is that also a time? I mean, you can always dedicate.
You can always dedicate that goodness. Because what you're doing is creating bonds of affinity of goodness. And there's a really nice example of there's a monk I know who spent his life in Thailand kind of strongly. He's a very well-known kind of preacher, speaker of Dhamma, Lupampaninaha. So very well-known, very famous. And one of the things he's famous for is speaking out against superstition. So that anything that he felt was superstitions or wasn't really supported by a really clear application of the teachings. Really, you know, get rid of this stuff. The culture is inundated with, you know, really superstitious and foolish things. So he could speak very strongly. I remember talking, I traveled with him many times as his attendant and translator. And he was talking one time, and he was saying, and somebody asked him about, you know, isn't that dedication of merit just a whole bunch of superstitious hooey, you know? And he said, well, you know, my experience is that it's not. And he said, then I'll give an example recently of he's from the south of Thailand, where you know, there's a lot of coastal line and a lot of fishermen. And he said that somebody from around his home, fishermen, their boat, they're out at sea, fishing, big storm, boat sunk, rest of the crew died, and he wasn't found. So they just assumed he was dead, and they started doing the funeral ceremonies along with the others who were found. And and that person was not a particularly devout Buddhist, and he said, but he was at sea for many days, and he said the only time he got relief from the kind of discomfort and thirst was at the same time in his village when all his relatives and friends were doing dedications of merit and blessings. He said, that's the only time he ever felt comfortable. And he ended up being rescued and survived. But that's an interesting perspective. Taylor?
I remember reading that in heaven, when a god is approaching death and his radiance is beginning to fade, his fellow wise gods come to him and they say to him, when you die, seek a human birth. And once you've done that, become established in the Dhamma. And once you become established in the Dhamma, go and teach it to others. So it just gives a sense that there's this cosmological, like, you know, this great backdrop to the Buddha's teachings. And makes me feel like more people should know about it, but they don't. But the wise gods, I guess they know.
Yeah. Apparently. Very good. Julia.
Thank you. This might be a little, well, no, it's not tangential. So in the Vajrayana tradition, there are certain practices, and one of them, you know, you visualize this column of light in the middle of you, and then there's this sort of circular opening, and you go out the top of your head, and you're supposed to practice before you die, you know, having the mind all peaceful and being one with the clear light, and then going out through the top of your head and merging, you know, with all. And so I'm wondering if there's any sort of related practice in this tradition or any complement to it. Just wondering, like, because they practice before whatever happens, practitioners.
Yeah, in terms of, there's not the same kind of, I mean, that's one of the strengths of the Vajrayana, is that they've got many specific practices that they do. In the Theravada, there tends to be, say, less specific, but the certainly that cultivation of establishing the mind peacefully, establishing the mind in awareness and being able to rest in awareness is your fundamental home ground. And there's a really lovely talk that Ajahn Chah gave to an elderly woman who was approaching death. And the title of the talk is Our Real Home, and that the reference is that our real home being our kind of awareness and the quality of knowing clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the establishing that home base. Yeah.
Yeah, I understand how the ritual benefits people who are still alive, but something you read suggested it also benefits the person who passed.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that person was reborn immediately. So how mm-hmm. did it benefit that person? Can that be?
Well, that's where that's where you start getting into the whole realms of various speculations and controversies, and different schools of Buddhism hold it in different ways, and then it gets really complicated. Because certainly, I would say that's in terms of the doctrinal position of the Theravada, their immediate rebirth. But then it isn't really defined what rebirth is. So then you start going into, because all the, your say the realm of ghosts and spirits and deities are all realms of rebirth. So that those are, and that's where in that discourse that the Buddha gives, so he's saying specifying particular realms where specifically amenable or receptive to those dedications of merit, but none of it is lost, and then you get into I think one of the things in terms of the dedication of merit is because it's one's drawing on the affinity, in terms of present moment, bringing the memory of somebody to mind is establishing that connection within consciousness, and then bringing that to mind and generating that sincere wish of well-wishing and wanting to be a force for their happiness and well-being. Just that, I think, in terms of this is not doctrinal. This is my conception of it, in the sense that once one starts to establish that kind of sincere wish, then the boundaries of birthplace, physical body, realms of existence start to fall away. Yeah.
I think that talking about merit is basically it's faith driven. And so in cultivating faith, there really aren't any limitations as to where that can take you. So it has real value.
Yeah.
I have two friends in Thailand who are both doctors and very sophisticated and successful. They went to medical school in the United States. They have parents who are doctors who went to medical school in the United States.
Yeah.
And there's a third brother who died like that, young, about 42 years old, and just collapsed and died. And they both decided to ordain for a couple of weeks. And I actually saw them at the monastery to make merit. And when we were talking about the making of merit, what they were doing is they were ordained, hopefully making merit, hopefully that they would rejoin with their brother in a future lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And these are pretty sophisticated people.
So these are, I think that's a, again, that's where it's like a Buddhist culture, then you've got lots of possibilities are kind of limitless, really, because it's so much is accomplished through the mind and through that sincere heart, and I'll give. I mean, that's a really positive. But there's a circumstance where a woman who I know, her daughter was killed in a bus crash, and then the two daughters, an elder and a younger, and they were 16 and 17 or 16 and 18 at the time, and mothers. One of them died. One of them was seriously injured, and the one who died, the mother kept. Every time she did something good, she was dedicating the merit so that the daughter would be reborn in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And her brother wasn't getting married, her sister wasn't getting married, and it just wasn't happening. And the girl who had passed away started appearing to people. Appearing to people at Wat Nanachat, saying, "I'm stuck in this kind of limbo, and I'm tired of it." And so that it coincided with a time that I came to one of my visits. So then the family came to me because the mother had a lot of faith in me. So then I had to ask her just making it clear and saying, "You've got to let go. You've got to let go of your daughter. You've got to allow her to take rebirth wherever is going to happen." And then so we ended up doing a meal offering. We went down to where, because they'd offered a kuti in the women's section. Some of her ashes were there, a picture. So we went down and we did some chanting and dedication of merit, and then with the mother holding that letting go and that dedication of merit for whatever the daughter wanted, wherever she wanted to be reborn. And then there was no problem after that. So we live in a fairly limited concept of the world. And it's very, very material in the West. And you realize there's a lot more happening than what we could see. And it's really helpful to say, oh yeah, the goodness that we do, the intentions that we hold, there's an effect there. Also, really holding those good intentions.
Yes. So, say a family member that passed away, perchance, turned into a hungry ghost.
Mm-hmm.
How might one help them when they're in that realm to move on?
That's actually that's where the, say, classically, doctrinally, that's where those offerings of merit, dedications of merit, are most efficacious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It works.
Thank you. So then that works the same kind of way if the person that's passed on has not really had that much merit? Like if they've...
Well, yeah, I mean, in the end, it's sort of you can't rely on others. So we end up reaping the fruits of our own actions. But you know, also sort of looking at the grand scale of things, it's not about Buddhist concepts of right and wrong and merit and not merit, but it's more like these are fundamental truths of we go through cycles of birth and death dependent on our actions, and they have results, but it's over long periods of time. And the fact that somebody even has a human birth, it's like Taylor's bringing up of the wise gods advise those gods who are take a human birth, because human birth is really, that's where it's happening. And so that the fact that we've taken human birth, or anybody has the merit to take human birth, have a storehouse of goodness. And, you know, sometimes people don't act on it, and sometimes people act on it incredibly. But over time, you realize anybody who's taken rebirth in the human realm has got this backlog of goodness that if they seeded it, it really bear incredible fruit. Let's have a bit of a break. Come back in 15 minutes.